The next section of chapter 4 is Subversive Universals, on page 75. Any elaboration of an alternative image of progress must inevitably face up to the problem of universalism, the idea that certain values, ideas, and goals may hold across all cultures. Footnote 31. Capitalism, as we have argued, is an expansionary universal that weaves itself through multiple cultural fabrics, networking them as it goes along. Anything less than a competing universal will end up being smothered by an all-embracing series of capitalist relations. Footnote 32. Various particularisms, localized, specific forms of politics and culture, cohabitate with ease in the world of capitalism. The list of possibilities continues to grow as capitalism differentiates into Chinese capitalism, American capitalism, Brazilian capitalism, Indian capitalism, Nigerian capitalism, and so on. If defending a particularism is insufficient, it is because history shows us that the global space of universalism is a space of conflict, with each contender requiring the relative provincialization of its competitors. Footnote 33. If the left is to compete with global capitalism, it needs to rethink the project of universalism. But to invoke such an idea is to call forth a number of fundamental critiques directed against universalism in recent decades. While a universal politics must move beyond any local struggles, generalizing itself at the global scale and across cultural variations, it is for these very reasons that it has been criticized. Footnote 34. As a matter of historical record, European modernity was inseparable from its, quote, dark side, unquote, a vast network of exploited colonial dominions, the genocide of indigenous peoples, the slave trade, and the plundering of colonized nations' resources. Footnote 35. In this conquest, Europe presented itself as embodying the universal way of life. All other peoples were simply residual particulars that would inevitably come to be subsumed under the European way, even if this required ruthless physical violence and cognitive assault to guarantee the outcome. Linked to this was a belief that the universal was equivalent to the homogeneous. Differences between cultures would therefore be erased in the process of particulars being subsumed under the universal, creating a culture modeled in the image of European civilization. This was a universalism indistinguishable from pure chauvinism. Through this process, Europe dissimulated its own parochial position by deploying a series of mechanisms to efface the subjects who made these claims: white, heterosexual, property-owning males. Europe and its intellectuals abstracted away from their location and identity, presented their claims as grounded in a, quote, view from nowhere, unquote, footnote 36. This perspective was taken to be untarnished by racial, sexual, national, or any other particularities, providing the basis for both the alleged universality of Europe's claims and the illegitimacy of other perspectives. While Europeans could speak and embody the universal, other cultures could only be represented as particular and parochial. Universalism has therefore been central to the worst aspects of modernity's history. A brief aside here, I'm noticing a little bit of a ringing sound. I don't know if it's been there all along. I just started noticing it. If it just added in, I apologize for that. Anyway, it is what it is. If I had better tools, I would try and figure out how to fix it. But I'm just going to continue. Given this heritage, it might seem that the simplest response would be to rescind the universal from our conceptual arsenal. But, for all the difficulties with the idea, it nevertheless remains necessary. The problem is partly that one cannot simply reject the concept of the universal without generating other significant problems. Most notably, giving up on the category leaves us with nothing but a series of diverse particulars. There appears no way to build meaningful solidarity in the absence of some common factor. The universal also operates as a transcendent ideal, never satisfied with any particular embodiment, and always open to striving for better. Footnote 37. It contains the conceptual impulse to undo its own limits. Rejecting this category also risks orientalizing other cultures, transforming them into an exotic other. If there are only particularisms, and provincial Europe is associated with reason, science, progress, and freedom, then the unpleasant implication is that non-Western cultures must be devoid of these. The old Orientalist divides are inadvertently sustained in the name of a misguided anti-universalism. On the other hand, one risks licensing all sorts of oppressions as simply the inevitable consequence of plural cultural forms. All the problems of cultural relativism reappear if there are no criteria to discern which global knowledges, politics, and practices support a politics of emancipation. Given all of this, it is unsurprising to see aspects of universalism pop up throughout history and across cultures. Footnote 38. To see even its critics begrudgingly accept its necessity, footnote 39, and to see a variety of attempts to revise the category, footnote 40. To maintain this necessary conceptual tool, the universal must be identified not with an established set of principles and values, but rather with an empty placeholder that is impossible to fill definitively. Universals emerge when a particular comes to occupy this position through hegemonic struggle. Footnote 40. Excuse me, 41. The particular, parenthetical quote, Europe, comes to represent itself as the universal, parenthetical quote, global. It is not simply a false universal, though, as there is a mutual contamination. The universal becomes embodied in the particular, while the particular loses some of its specifics in functioning as the universal. Yet there can never be a fully achieved universalism, and universals are therefore always open to contestation from other universals. This is what we will later outline in politico-strategic terms as counter-hegemony, a project aimed at subverting an existing universalism in favor of a new order. This leads us to our second point. As counter-hegemonic, universals can have a subversive and liberating strategic function. On the one hand, a universal makes an unconditional demand, everything must be placed under its rule, footnote 42. Yet, on the other hand, universalism is never an achieved project. Even capitalism remains incomplete. This tension renders any established hegemonic structure open to contestation and enables universals to function as insurrectionary vectors against exclusions. For example, the concept of universal human rights, problematic as it may be, has been put to use by numerous movements, ranging from local housing struggles to international justice for war crimes. Its universal and unconditional demand has been mobilized in order to highlight those who are left out of its protections and rights. Similarly, feminists have criticized certain concepts as exclusionary of women, and mobilized universal claims against their constraints. As in the use of the universal idea of, quote, all humans are equal, unquote. In such cases, the particular, parenthetical quote, woman, becomes a way to prosecute a critique against an existing universal, quote, humanity. Meanwhile, the previously established universal, humanity, becomes revealed as a particular, man. Footnote 43. These examples show that universals can be revitalized by the struggles that both challenge and elucidate them. In this regard, quote, to appeal to universalism as a way of asserting the superiority of Western culture is to betray universality, but to appeal to universalism as a way of dismantling the superiority of the West is to realize it. Footnote 44. And I'm actually going to repeat that last quote because I feel like I didn't read it as well as I could have. To appeal to universalism as a way of asserting the superiority of Western culture is to betray universality. But to appeal to universalism as a way of dismantling the superiority of the West is to realize it. Universalism, on this account, is the product of politics, not a transcendent judge standing above the fray. We can now turn to one final aspect of universalism, which is its heterogeneous nature. Footnote 45. As capitalism makes clear, universalism does not entail homogeneity. It does not necessarily involve converting diverse things into the same kind of thing. In fact, the power of capitalism is precisely its versatility in the face of changing conditions on the ground, and its capacity to accommodate difference. A similar prospect must also hold for any leftist universal. It must be one that integrates difference rather than erasing it. What, then, does all of this mean for the project of modernity? It means that any particular image of modernity must be open to co-creation and further transformation and alteration. And in a globalized world where different peoples necessarily coexist, it means building systems to live in common despite the plurality of ways of life. Contrary to Eurocentric accounts and classic images of universalism, it must recognize the agency of those outside Europe and the necessity of their voices in building truly planetary and universal futures. The universal, then, is an empty placeholder that hegemonic particulars, specific demands, ideals, and collectives, come to occupy. It can operate as a subversive and emancipatory vector of change with respect to established universalisms, and it is heterogeneous and includes differences, rather than eliminating them. End of section.